to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime.
What's up, STS Nation? Right in time, Chris Anderson shows up. Welcome to another episode of Surviving the Survivor, the podcast that promises to bring you the very best guests in true crime. Having a little mini panic attack because I didn't see Chris Anderson, but there is his lovely face. And Chris, you're hearing us okay?
I'm hearing you fine, man. My apologies. I was trying to make myself look better for the camera tonight.
You cannot possibly look better, Chris Anderson. And if you will look at his chyron, as they say on TV, it says Chief Chris Anderson, because that is what he is now. But we welcome you back to Surviving the Survivor. New York police appear to have cracked a 13-year-old case out on Long Island. And the accused serial killer, a guy whose name is Rex Huerman, he appeared in court just this past Tuesday. He was charged with murder in the deaths of three of 11 victims whose bodies piled up on Suffolk County's Gilgo Beach beginning back in 2010. But you got to wonder when these killings actually started. And we're going to ask our guests about that. The other big question, and these are the best guests you can ask about it, is where does this investigation head now? Speaking of our guests, best guest tonight, Chief Chris Anderson, formerly a detective sergeant, a retired Birmingham Police Department veteran with 27 years of experience in law enforcement. He co-hosted Investigation Discovery, their series Reasonable Doubt, and previously solved crimes on air in real time for A&E's First 48 Birmingham. He is also a host of the Crime and Cookie Juice podcast and author of the just released book, The Case. And an all-around great guy and an all-around great woman, Cheryl Mack McCollum. She is an active CSI investigator. She's an Emmy Award winning part of CBS 46's CSI Atlanta. She's director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. She's a writer for Crime Online. She works with Nancy Grace frequently. She's the co-author of the textbook Cold Case Pathways to Justice. She does it all. And then you've got Dr. Joni Johnston, who everyone says looks just like Ashley Judd. And I know we're going to get the comments, which is a compliment, of course. She is a forensic psychologist, a private investigator, and a crime writer. As a practicing psychologist, she's worked in both medium maximum security prisons for the Board of Parole for the Superior Court of San Diego. She, too, has done it all and is the author of Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask. She hosts her own YouTube channel, Unmasking a Murderer. To you, Dr. Johnston, what is the biggest question people have regarding serial killers, since that's what we're going to be talking about tonight?
I think the most common question I get is basically, is it nature or nurture? You know, are serial killers born or are they made? And I think that, you know, that's a very valid question. I think the answer, unfortunately, in a way, in terms of profiling or those kinds of things, is it's typically a perfect storm, a combination of nature and nurture. So you have somebody who's born with certain genetic predispositions. If they're raised in a certain way, those predispositions, which might be problematic in other circumstances, kind of are dormant. Or they don't kind of blossom. But if you have that predisposition in combination with some adverse childhood experiences, along with some other things that happen as they go on in life, you can create that rare perfect storm that turns into a serial killer.
And that was a question I asked yesterday. Are you born? Are you a naturally born killer in the case of someone like Rex Huerman? A quick reminder, please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We are at Podcast STS. On Instagram, I post family photos. You see the other side of all this. You can support us at Patreon. You can also become a YouTube member. The merch store is open. And some happy news today. Good old Karn over here, the cardboard cutout. The real one became a great grandmother. My niece had a baby, a healthy baby boy. So shout out to great grandmother Karn now, who will be hosting not this Sunday, but the following Sunday. Some news as well. We're finding out there's going to be a press conference tomorrow morning, 10:30 a.m. on the Long Island serial killer. the latest with Rex Sherman. What that press conference is about, we don't yet know. We are going to take it live here tomorrow at 10:30 in the morning. We're going to have attorney Randy Zellin joining us and hopefully a former law enforcement officer to help break it down. And then 5 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, you've got Scott Duffy and Phil Waters, two of the best investigators who are going to take a deeper dive into what we learn tomorrow. Meanwhile, the victims in all this, as Chief Anderson knows, can't forget about them. Rex Huerman is accused of murdering three, and he's the prime suspect in the fourth killing. Some are wondering if the press conference is about that fourth person tomorrow. We will find out. But the three women he is accused of murdering, Amber Lynn Costello, 27, Melissa Barthelemy, 24, and Megan Waterman, 22. Let's keep them in our thoughts. The fourth, who's a prime suspect in the killing of, is Maureen Brainerd Barnes, 25 years old. Collectively, they have become known as the Gilgo Four. Chief Anderson, just from a bird's eye view, looking down from the sky, what stands out to you about this case? This is about as heinous as it gets if this guy, Rex Sherman, is in fact responsible for all these murders.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of hard to talk about serial killers, man, when, you know, when, like in my career, I worked a lot of homicide cases, a whole lot of homicide cases. But, you know, you rarely get to see a true serial killer. And usually by the time you figure out that they're a serial killer, they have killed multiple people. So that stands out to me. And one thing that I've recognized as being a working homicide cases is, you know, the way that most of these serial killers get caught quickly is, and I say quickly, it could be a span of 5 to 10 years. That's quick to me. Or even we had one, one of the most, well, the most memorable cases that I had was a serial killer that went from Florida all the way up to, I can't even remember how far. I think it was St. Louis, and he left bodies every state that he was in, and then he did all of that over the span of about 3 or 4 days. So you know, so there are some cases where you'll find a serial killer case that you can catch really quickly, and then there are some that go for a very long period of time, like this guy did. So some of the things that just stand out to me is that, you know, there are still a lot of questions that are open. One thing that I've recognized being from serial killers is they don't sometimes, and this is probably the way that they get caught, in most cases, they don't change what they do. They will, you know, you'll see them pick a certain type of person. You'll see them pick a certain area. They won't change the manner of death. But as I read more and more about this case, this guy had little subtle changes in certain things that he did. And I'm sure Dr. Ashley Judd would probably be able to explain that a lot better than I could. But from a boots to the ground type work that I did on homicide investigations, you know, those are some of the things that, you know, that just stand out to me. And it's really intriguing. It's intriguing to me being that I'm from this type of work.
And Mac, to you, we were talking about this last night. We had some Ann Burgess on, Mark Safarek, some of the best criminal profilers in the entire world. And they were doing the math. You know, it goes back 13 years. He's 59 now. Yep. They say it's really doubtful that he only started killing at 46 because serial killers typically start in their teens, if not 20s. Do you agree with that? Do you think that there's much more that we don't know about? And does this go way further back than 2009, 2010?
I don't think there's any question about it. And here's one thing that leaped out at me when I was watching this thing live. When they're bringing out the one Tupperware thing that had the Playboy magazine on it, I did a quick search of that magazine and I think I found it. And I think it's from 1984. And it's the magazine that had the last nude pictures of Marilyn Monroe. That magazine to me in that photograph looked like it was in pristine condition. Like my husband has some baseball cards and things like that that he takes care of. That's how that magazine looked. If he's had that magazine since 1984 and it ain't been up and ripped and, you know, whatnot, that tells you again what is important to this man. And there are people, there's all kind of theories about what happened to Marilyn Monroe. Was she murdered? Was she not? You know, she was found nude and all those sorts of things. So if that's when this started for him, that would check out better for me than start when he was 40. I think you're looking at somebody 24, 25 for sure.
So you think the number right now is 3 murders. It could go up potentially. We don't know what they're going to talk about tomorrow, but they might tie in this 4th victim, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, who was 25 when she was murdered. Yeah. But you think the number is going to be higher than 4?
I think the number is going to be much higher than 4. I think you're going to add states as well as victims. And I was just talking to Lisa Rybakov. Mm-hmm. I don't know if y'all know her, but she is extraordinary. She's fantastic. She does polygraphs. And she can text as quick as she can talk in that New York accent. And she was, you know, she and I were talking, and I think it's probably going to be Barnes tomorrow. The backdrop being the DA's office is clear to me, and that's usually they're going to add charges. And I think the DNA is going to come back and it's going to link her. But again, and I would love for, you know, the chief and Doc to weigh in on this too, but people ask me all the time about Gilbert. And here's my answer. What are the odds that somebody is going to get an escort who's petite, who they're going to bring to Long Island and throw in that swampy marsh, and they just happen to throw their victim in a dumping ground of a serial killer?
Yeah.
That's hard for me to believe.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mac, as always, brings up a bunch of good points. Dr. Joni Johnston, what about this point that Mac just made, that this Playboy came out in immaculate mint condition from 1984? Is that any sort of hint that he was, you know, small hint, big hint, or whatever size hint, that he was, I don't know, super interested protecting these sorts of images going all the way back, you know, 4 decades or whatever 1984 is at this point. What does that tell you, if anything?
Well, I think Mac made a couple of really good points. One being, I think the way people treat their objects or the things they have in their possession do tell us a lot about how much they value them, for one thing. The fact that they're in their home tells you that they value them. So that's certainly a tell in terms of his personality and his values and things that he kind of treasures or whatever. And I would agree, and I'm probably every expert you've had on this show is, you know, who's done research and done work in this area would probably agree that it would be very unusual for him to start killing at 43, 44, 45 years old. I mean, it's just almost unheard of. Now, I guess it's possible that what I would definitely not doubt, you know, I guess, is it possible that he started killing, I guess, in his 40s? I guess it's possible. I don't believe that either. At the very least, though, I think this person has a history of, you know, sexually deviant behaviors dating back for years. So is it possible he started peeping or voyeurism or whatever and progressed like some sex offenders do to rape and those kinds of things, S&M stuff that's non-consensual, and then graduated at some point later in his life to murder? I guess that's possible. That's the only alternative I see than him having a series of other victim bodies out there that we're going to discover, hopefully, if he did do it.
Yeah, which is it's a scary thought. With this press conference coming up tomorrow, you've got to wonder what else is coming the public's way. And you've got to feel for all the victims and their families who've been in court. And obviously also Rex Huerman's own family, his wife, was totally blindsided, which we'll get to. Questions already coming in. Good to see I am not T-Pain back in the house. I'll toss this one to you, Chief. Is there any chance that Rex's brother was a co-conspirator in any of these murders, or any possibility that he has helped him with other murders we may not know about yet? Chief Anderson, you are a seasoned investigator. There's some strange stories about this brother who lives in South Carolina going after someone with some kind of blunt instrument, temperamental. Would you be talking to him and trying to find out if there was any connection?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to talk to him, or you wouldn't be doing your job as an investigator. I mean, to go and know that there's a history of violence behind this gentleman, and that he has a brother who's now stands accused of several different murders in the manner that they were, these victims were murdered. Absolutely. You have to go talk to him. Is it possible that he's involved? Yeah, it's always possible, but it's up to the investigators to, number one, either link him to the crime or eliminate him from it. And, you know, is it, he could very well be implicated in these crimes, but you never know, but you got to go talk to him.
And Chief, in your own experience, what was the difference? You said you handled very few serial killers because there are a few of them relative to regular homicides, but what's the striking difference between your sort of garden variety murderer as opposed to a serial killer? What have you noticed the differences to be?
So, okay. And I hate to use the term garden variety murder, but you know,
probably an incentive term. You know what I'm saying? Just right, kind of,
I got you.
A person who's murdering out of passion or, you know, violence, but not intent on serial killing.
Right. So if you look back at most homicides, it's been my experience. Most homicides are the people that are responsible usually have some sort of connection with the victim. I think I've said that hundreds of times with you. There's usually some sort of connection, whether it's they were friends, ex-lovers, they were had a relationship of drug dealing. It could be any type of relationship. And if you find the connection in the majority of your homicides, you'll be able to solve it. But when you deal with a serial killer in my profession are those whodunit cases. And the term whodunit is used by us homicide investigators to tell people, you know, you don't have any clue because they are random victims. Most of the time they are random victims. There is no connection to this person. You could have like the relationship is not like a long term, a long standard relationship. Like in this case, this guy was getting escorts. Well, how many, you know, these girls were probably seeing 2, 3, maybe 4 men per night. So that's not a real relationship. That's not a real connection. So it makes it harder when you're an investigator, when there's not a connection you get. And this is just a whodunit case. And especially when you don't have it's a nobody case. Those are extremely hard to solve. Very hard. So kudos to the investigators that have been working these cases, because I know how hard these cases. I have a case right now that is a nobody case. I know exactly who did it. I believe that there is evidence that exists to link the person who's responsible, but this guy has walked this earth for close to 30 years. It may be over 30 years now that I think about it. But because we don't have the body, there's not enough evidence to link him to the crime. So kudos to the investigators. It is the most frustrating type of investigation that you could ever conduct, because sometimes you get very, very close, know who's responsible and can't charge them just because you don't have enough evidence to do it. But you still have to keep going.
And Chris, does that still eat away at you now that you're retired from the Birmingham PD, the fact that you can't quite nab this guy?
Absolutely. I was thinking about it on my way home today, you know, and there are multiple cases that I have that were, you know, I solved a lot of my cases, but there are a few of them that went unsolved. And I retired in a time, and I hate to take over the interview, but this is something that I have to say. There have been a lot of cases. I love to see the way that the technology and the science is becoming more involved in investigations, because I retired at a time where, if you look at it now, I retired at a time where the technology was in its infancy. You know, we were just beginning to get to DNA, and it was just coming back within a time span. I remember a time span where it would take months to get some sort of DNA back from, and it not even linked. It's just to have it coded. You know, it would take months. But now you can get DNA back in days, hours, minutes, you know, because of all the new systems. So I love to see the way the technology has increased in investigations, but I also have some problems with it. So, you know, yes, do I get frustrated? What I love, on my drive home, I was thinking about, man, if you could retire and just go back and work about 5 or 6 of the cases that I know, with the technology that exists today, I know I have 5 or 6 cases that I could close within a year. Yeah.
There you go. That guy better watch out, whoever he is.
Exactly.
Laura Werner says, my two Southern faves, Mac in Atlanta and Chris in Birmingham, and I'm right on the Georgia-Alabama border. There you go. Our friend Catherine Regier in Hawaii, aloha to you, Dr. Johnston, wondering what the chances are of a confession. He reportedly, you know, said initially he didn't commit the crimes and began to cry, all 6'6" of them. In every direction, as I like to say. But what are the chances this guy confesses if he did commit these crimes at some point?
I think they're pretty slim. I mean, he does not seem like the kind of person who would confess unless his back is up against the wall, you know, maybe to avoid the death penalty or something like that. I think if he eventually was to confess, he might get a thrill out of that, at that point, kind of entertaining everybody with all the stories of what he's done and how he did it and those kinds of things as a way to kind of relive things and, you know, maybe torture the investigators who are sitting in there listening. That wouldn't surprise me because I think he's shown an interest already in the media and the coverage and that kind of thing. But I think unless it comes down to, again, the, you know, the writings on the wall for him, I don't think he believes it is at this point. Even though there seems to be a lot of evidence against him. But I think it would take a tremendous, like the death penalty, which I don't think even think they have it in New York. But it would take something very compelling, I think, for him to confess.
And there's a lot of news in this case, stuff that came out since our show just last night. Suffolk County prosecutors, Mac, I'm going to throw this one to you. They've now announced publicly that they want to collect more DNA evidence in their case against Rex Heuermann. And they're seeking a court order for a buccal swab. I don't know, never know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. First of all, tell everyone, what is that and why are they doing this right now?
A buccal swab is basically a Q-tip where they go on the inside of his mouth and they swab it to get those cells, to get his actual DNA, to say this is absolutely him, the person that you see, the name that we know, this is his DNA. So that they can, again, cross-check it so there's no question what came back on that pizza, you know, slice and the pizza crust and the other evidence that hopefully that they're going to be linking. And I think that's one thing they're going to address tomorrow.
Baby doll, haven't seen her in a while. STS Nation in the house. Happy to have her. Right back to you, Dr. Johnston, here from our friend in Ireland, Miss Wee Lassie. Do either the panel or the panel members know whether society ever truly knows the full body count of serial killers? Could they all have more unknown deaths? Dr. Johnston, is it possible with a guy like Rex Heuermann that we never know the totality of his crimes? And I assume different serial killers have just different personalities. Some want you to know the total. Others even embellish the total. But what say you about this question?
I think it's a great question. I think absolutely. You know, there are so many serial killers who've gone one way or the other. You know, they end up being charged with two, for example, and that we know they've committed 10, 15, 20. They won't tell you where they are. We don't know where they are. And so we're kind of left. They go to the grave saying, I didn't do these or whatever. So it's very hard to trust, I think, what a serial killer in general says. And then you have the flip scenario, right? You have somebody who's caught and then they confess to 500 murders or, you know, 300 murders because they want to somehow win this competition for having the highest body count. So there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that there are plenty of serial killers who have killed more people than we know about. And then again, there's some who have killed less probably than they're saying, that they're bragging about.
Yeah. Raul Thomas, Chief Anderson, I'd like to know how New Jersey is doing on linking unsolved homicide cases and or missing person cases during the time of Rex's first marriage while a resident of New Jersey. I know Atlantic City, there was a similar type killings in Atlantic City, and Atlantic City authorities have come out and said they don't believe there's a connection. But Chris Anderson, Cheryl said earlier that she believes it's going to be multi-state murders. How do you even begin as an investigator on this case, on this particular case, to go through the various states that he's been in, including South Carolina, New Jersey, I believe Massachusetts? How do you even start? How do you cross-reference everything to see if this guy is your man in other killings?
That's where your cooperation with other departments come into play. You send out, I mean, and I hate to date myself, but, you know, it seems some of this stuff, it seems almost wow, I wish we could have had that during my time. And I just retired almost, what, 8 years ago, you know? So, but that's where the cooperation between departments come into play. You know, you send them copies of what you have, you know, not everything, but you send them copies. You can email it to them. You can pick up the phone and call them. You know, now you can FaceTime them and tell them, you know, there's so many ways to connect with other departments. Back in my day, oh my gosh, I hate the way that sounds too, but back when I was investigating cases and I was working homicide cases, you had to send them a teletype message on the computer. You know, I remember having to do that. And there's no way you can get everything that you need to have in those little teletype messages. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it's going to take a lot of cooperation between cooperations within the departments. They're going to have to go back in their cold case files, look at some of these cases, even go back. I mean, you know, this guy's in his, when he's in his,
he's 59,
59. Yeah. So he's almost 60 years old. So yeah, you got to go back to when he was a teenager and look at everything, pull all your cases. And then, you know, one thing that I hate that makes cases like this harder is because he targeted a group of people who we all know that are some of the most underreported victims of criminal acts, you know. So there may be some that haven't even been reported yet. You know, I would, and there it's so many ways that you'll have to do it, but it's gonna take, you know, cooperating with other investigators, letting them know that hey, we have information that this guy stayed in this area during this time. Do you have any unsolved cases that matches this criteria? And then you have to widen the scope of the search also. So, yeah.
Hey, Joel, can I jump in here?
100%.
I think the chief and Doc will agree with me. Absolutely, he targeted a certain group. But let me tell you about that group. Let me tell you about that track. There is not one prostitute, hooker, sex worker that don't know who's in your town. Mm-hmm. And now that you've got a face and now that you've got a name, you're going to have people that are going to come forward and say, I knew that guy. I wouldn't fool with that guy. I wouldn't get in his car. Here's the reason that is so freaking critical. These are people that are violated and harmed and just misused in every facet of their life. Mm-hmm. They get paid to do things wives and girlfriends don't want to do. They wouldn't even ask them to do that are so twisted and so freaky and so just vulgar. And they'll do it. So if there's somebody that won't fool with him, that will tell you the level this man was on.
Mm. And that's interesting. Also, it's an interesting point to make because he is not the kind of guy that just blends in. He's a monstrous guy. So, yeah. You know, even at 22, you know, same size, and they're going to be able to, you know, hopefully pick him out of potential lineups, things of that nature, if it comes to that. Can't agree with Baby Doll more. You look good, Chris, always with the fire emoji. There you go. I'm excited to get to Mac and the chief on the investigation, but a couple more things with the DNA here. So prosecutors came out. They say that they already have this DNA link to Rex Huerman from a hair found on the body of a 22-year-old murder victim, Megan Waterman. They're now looking for more evidence. And the quote from the assistant district attorney, if the defendant's DNA from a buccal swab sample matches the mitochondrial DNA profile developed from Megan Waterman's remains, there is scientific evidence of the defendant's contact not only with Miss Waterman and where her remains were discovered, but also with the burlap utilized to restrain and transport her human remains. To you, Mac, once again, as a CSI investigator, how critical is just a single hair that can tie all this together potentially?
It is absolutely the money tree. And, you know, like the chief said, when you're talking about working a scene that is swampy and wet with animal activity and the decomposition is already in full swing, and they were able to find a single hair on burlap. You're talking about hands and knees with, you know, your eyes right on that evidence. So you're talking about, to me, an investigation that we're going to study because they've done such an incredible job here, period. From taking the pizza crust and getting DNA to finding the one hair strand and linking these folks together. Because again, you may not have hair on all the burlap, but it's all the same. And of the four of us, the four of us in the last year have probably been to 100 dinner parties. You ain't seen no burlap in anybody's house. I mean, people don't use that. So that is unusual enough for you to stop exactly what you're doing and hang your tree right there every time.
Snazzy trinkets, jewelry, press conference tomorrow. I'm hoping more charges are coming. We are going to carry that live, hopefully 10:30 a.m. with a couple of investigators and an attorney. Dr. Joni Johnston, I immediately, when I read about all this, said, what's the deal with this burlap? Do you have any thoughts, from your perspective, was it some sort of a obsessive compulsive type thing where he had to use the same material? Is it just coincidence? Any thoughts on why burlap is involved in all this?
Well, I think the significance might be the fact that he puts all the victims in the same thing. So I think that may have some symbolism for him. The burlap itself may have just been a convenience thing. I don't know that we can make too much about that. I've heard that he's a duck hunter and that there's some connection possibly with this burlap being a canvas burlap or kind of a camouflage burlap. So I think, it is kind of hard to make some kind of psychological analysis of what the burlap itself means. But I do think the fact that the way he placed them, the way he wrapped them all definitely has some psychological significance for him.
Mm. Papa Bear, a shout out to her from Moscow, Idaho. Of course, now the infamous home of where the murders happened at the University of Idaho. So a place that's near and dear to our heart. We're thinking of Papa Bear and everyone in Moscow, and hopefully justice will be served there as well. And seriously, best guests ever. I tell you all the time, it's not just a tagline. It is the reality. We get you the best guests in all of true crime, and you are witnessing it. Tonight, catch up here. Missing Nancy Grace. Great to see Cheryl McCollum tonight. And then from Catherine, wow, Cheryl, interesting bio. They're all interesting peeps here. More to talk about with wife Asa Ellerup. She's been in the news a lot, Dr. Johnston, but the Daily Mail caught up with her. She, of course, is now the estranged wife of Rex Huerman. She returned to the family's Massapequa home last week, and she's now saying, and I heard she may have been on television as recently as this evening, so she's out there talking a little bit, but she said in this interview that she does not want to walk down the street. She doesn't want to hear her neighbors gossiping about the gruesome 13-year-old slayings. The neighbors, she says, want the house gone. The exact quote here is, look, I don't want to walk down the street. I heard what people said about us. I've heard it. I heard the other people in the neighborhood. They want the house bulldozed. Do you understand? She's telling the reporter, please, I can't talk anymore. This is always difficult because they are victims as well. We had Carrie Rawson on last night, the daughter of Dennis Rader, otherwise known as the BTK serial killer. She's dealing with all the trauma still. But is the media overstepping their bounds, in your opinion, by trying to approach this woman this early on?
I think they are. I do. I mean, I understand it. I definitely do, because we all want to know what she has to say. We all have a lot of questions about their relationship, about how long, what her thoughts were. Did she notice anything and those kinds of things? But I do feel like, she is in a state of shock, I'm sure, and depression and all kinds of things, grief. And so I think that those answers will come with time, as things start, as the court process progresses, and she has a more of a chance with her family to kind of regroup and kind of form their family in a different way. So I have to say, though, that I do think the media, again, understandably, want to hear from her. But I do think that some advocates, like the BTK's daughter, like Sherry, and some of the other people, have done a very good job of presenting this family as victims as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's progress, because I know in the past, because these crimes are so horrendous, when we have a serial killer who's killed such innocent people and who were out doing whatever they were doing, it doesn't matter. You know, they weren't asked to be murdered. You know, we're all enraged by this. We're enraged by this. And so it's very easy for that anger to spill over to the family of the perpetrator. And, you know, I've seen just the most horrendous things written before on Facebook pages, and you we hear about people writing things on their houses and that kind of thing. So I do think, even though I'm sure they're feeling overwhelmed, I'm sure they're hearing horrible things, I do think the media has also made more of an effort to separate out Rex Heuermann from his wife and his family. And I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah. And I become friends with Carrie and let her know that we're all thinking of her. And if she needs to take a break, she's well aware because she does get hounded by the media when stories like this come up, because there are very few children, understandably, of serial killers who want to speak publicly. And there are a lot of true crime fans out there who want to know. And so she gets tugged on a lot, and told her she's got to look out for herself first. But
amen.
New Jersey, cool chick. Got to give her a shout out. My home state does it again. Awesome panel of expert guests. And then I love these. Frankie Figgs, friends of the show. Ooh, Chris Anderson, love him. So getting those. Speaking of Chief Chris Anderson, Rex Heuermann was in court on Tuesday, and he reportedly was glaring at people in the courtroom. I don't know if that's just his resting glaring face or not, but basically the lawyers came out and said, look, there's not going to be a plea deal here. He has said, I did not do this. This is according to his defense attorney, who's a very savvy defense attorney, a guy named Michael Brown. Did any of this surprise you? Is Michael Brown just doing his job? What do you make of the court hearing?
Oh, no, it doesn't surprise me at all. You want to do as much as you can to sway anybody that may be on the fence and sitting up on that jury. So if they're going back and they may see an interview, you don't want to get out there and say, well, I don't know if this guy is innocent or guilty or not. Not as his defense attorney. No, you want to do as much as you can to help push your case, push your agenda in defending him. But I do kind of want to go back to something that we said, and we've talked about this and about the DNA that was found in with the that belongs to the defendant in the case. We have to be extremely careful about DNA, especially with the way that technology is going today. Mitochondrial DNA and hair DNA, it's easy to exchange. And I'm a cop. I am a homicide investigator. I cut my teeth in investigations and homicides. So there were plenty of times where if I saw some hair that belonged to somebody, I'm looking deep into this person, very, very deep. But now, and I wouldn't have changed my mindset and if I did not have a case that we did on reasonable doubt that showed me, look, we have to be careful with this DNA. And I don't want to say the young man's name because we are currently working out something to have him on Crime and Cookie Juice. But this young man was arrested, charged, and convicted for murdering his girlfriend. And the one thing that convicted him was a small sample of hair. That hair was found in an article of clothing, which was his pants, and it had blood on it. He stayed in prison for 14 or 15 years, I want to say it was, after he was convicted, and he's maintained his innocence the entire time. All right, we covered the show on Reasonable Doubt. Now, it that sounds like an open and shut case to me. I was ready to go once I read the write-up that they did on the case. You know, I see his DNA. He got this girl DNA in his bloody hair and his clothing. You know, why are we even here? That's what I was thinking. But the more you peel back the layers and the more you really, really look into the way that DNA is collected and how it's transferred and how easy it is now to transfer DNA and someone else find it, it really opened up my mind. That case, we got that young man some help. We aired his episode on Reasonable Doubt. And now, and this just happened recently, they found more DNA belonging to another man officers went and questioned that man, and he had the weapon that was used to kill the victim. This young man was 18 or 19 years old when he was convicted. He'd never been in any trouble. He got in the room with some very aggressive investigators, and he made an admission to the crime. And it was the admission and the DNA that they found in his pants is what got him convicted. If you look, when we looked at the case, I interviewed him, and I didn't think about it until after I had finished the interview. He said that he went to his girlfriend's house the night that she was missing, and he waited for her for hours. And I said, well, where did you wait on her? Well, I just sat on the steps. I sat on the steps. When I started looking back, I could picture a person that's responsible for this crime, locking all the doors, leaving out of the house, and maybe if they walk, because they walked through the crime scene, tracking a hair on the stairs that he walked down. The guy that was convicted in this case sitting in that same area and that piece of hair getting connected to his pants. Now, it's not like he had any blowback or anything on his pants. It was a simple piece of hair that wasn't even connected to his pants. When the crime scene investigator opened up the pants, the hair falls and he finds it. So we have to really be careful. Especially us as investigators, and look, it's hard to find DNA, but it's easy to transfer it. So we have to be careful about how much we rely on DNA. We have to peel back the layers and look at how that DNA was collected, how it came back, and hopefully there's some corroborating evidence, because that's the key, especially in this case, that needs to be some corroborating evidence in this case to make it a slam dunk case.
And that's a very interesting point, especially in light of what's going on with Brian Koberger and that touch DNA on the sheath. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there was news in that case today that we'll cover with Scott and Phil tomorrow. They've come out with an alibi, I believe, saying that Brian Koberger was driving around at the time of the murders. That was something that broke right before we went on air. So not the best of alibis, I don't think, okay. But we'll see what comes of that. And obviously, I just read the headline there in a couple of tweets, so we'll have to dig deeper into that just to show you we are, in fact, a global show. We've got Bridget in Australia. Great to see you home. Good to be back home. And then we've got Bedfordshire in England, which I'm probably mispronouncing. Back to you, Mac, and we're about to get into the meat and potatoes in a moment of the actual investigation.
All right.
The crime scene investigation at the house. But just before that, in court on Tuesday, they announced Suffolk County prosecutors that they handed over about 8 terabytes of material. That's about 2,500 pages of records, 100 hours of surveillance video. They say that that's basically a drop in the bucket. How much evidence will pile up in a case like this?
Ooh, y'all watched it. I mean, they've got storage rooms, they've got the house, they've got the vault, they've got his office, they've got computers. Let me just lay this out. They probably have, if this were my case, I would want an airplane hangar. Seriously. And I want tables where I can put pornography, weapons, restraints. I need it all out. I need it all separated so that I could start to understand. Because what the chief was saying is correct. Take the hair off the table. Mm-hmm. You have his cell phone and a burner phone that are moving together. Yes. That's bad for him. You've got searches on his computer that are bad for him that they've already put out. So that tells you they already knew. He was looking at torture porn. He was looking at Asian tinks. He was looking at these different things. And then lo and behold, you've got an Asian male in the same area dressed in women's clothing. Now all the other victims were nude. So again, if this were my case, I want to know why he's got on clothes, and I want to know why they're women's, and I want to know who they belong to. Is he wearing clothing from another woman? I want to know that. I want to know why 7 burner phones. I want to know, what is that about? Are those phones trophies from some of the victims, or are those phones representative of a different state? The answers are coming. But he picked it. If Rex is the killer, He decided 7 phones, not 4, not 1. He decided the dumping ground. He decided the burlap. He decided the strangle manual, you know, manual strangulation. Here's the other thing, and I want to make this point before I forget. Men will tell you what's important to them because it is what they spend their time and money on. So if it's $1,200 for golf clubs, if it's $5,000 for golf clubs, there's your answer. Rex is telling you those firearms mean the world to him because he encased them in thick cement. He also had 259, and the chief will tell you, when I get rid of guns in the evidence room, those guns are anywhere from $50 to $1,200. So if you're just looking at $350 as just a minimum cost for weapons, he has $100,000 worth of guns, even though the front porch of his house is being propped up by a 2x4. Mm-hmm. The house is not important to him. Those guns are. Do you understand? Doctor, so that's what I would focus on.
Interesting. I want to get back to all that in a minute. But Dr. Joni Johnson, I was going to ask you a different question, but since Mac brought it up, what do you make of the fact that his house is in such poor condition? But then, you know, Mac talked about this Playboy cover that was in mint condition from 1984. That's an interesting dichotomy right there. Mm-hmm. What do you make about the fact he's an architect also? So what about the fact that he had such little regard for his actual home, the physical appearance, but appeared to have other things, including some kind of vault or a dungeon of some sort that investigators found? But what do you make of it?
Yeah, it is very hard not to see it as a metaphor to some extent. You know, you have this outward appearance of this professional who's going to work in Manhattan, and he's dressed up, he looks presentable, and he's got this nice address where he works. And then you come home and you see what he's really like, you know, kind of the things that are falling down, they're old, they don't mean much of anything. And I think it does reflect a lot of respect, the dichotomy in this man. That this man really is leading a double life. He's almost showing us that, you know, physically. You can see where he's working and you see where he is at home. And then the vault, yeah, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see. It's hard for me not to think. And obviously I'm not like our two other guests who are the investigators who are going into the crime scenes and stuff. It's hard for me to imagine, if he is guilty of this, that he didn't kill at least one of them in the house. Just because of the amount of time I think he would want to spend with them, and to have complete domination and control over them while he was doing whatever he was doing to them. So, you know, when you talk about the lock or the vault or all those kind of things, it just makes me wonder, you know, but it is just so interesting to me from a psychological standpoint to see this incredible dichotomy between this house that he lives in, and he's an architect, as you pointed out, and then his work environment and how he presented himself at work.
That's super fascinating, because we were talking about with the profilers how Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, he termed it cubing. He could, you know, he could change the side he was showing you almost instantaneously, depending on which side he wanted you to see. Chief, to you, to Dr. Joni's point, do you think he killed in that house?
Oh, it is very, very possible. Like, you know, look, the one thing about criminals, you know, and I won't call it lazy, but sometimes, you know, they'll take pathways of less resistance. I mean, if you feel like you can bring a body into your house and not alert your family, you know, and you're the type of person, you're the type of a serial killer that likes to spend a lot of time with your victims, and they are precious to you, then absolutely, Doc is absolutely spot on. Yeah, I would not doubt it that he killed in that house. But I can tell you this, the investigators are combing through that house with a fine tooth comb, as they should be, and they should be looking into his background to see if there is the possibility that he may have had access to another property or another area, because I would seriously doubt that he picked up a person, committed the murder, and then discarded the body. No, he doesn't he doesn't appear to be that type of a serial killer. He appears to, those are his possessions. Those are the things that he loved. Just like he didn't take, he wouldn't take care of the roof of the front porch of his house. He's going to take care of his next victim because those are precious to him. And Mac is absolutely, I think both of you, our guests tonight, they are absolutely spot on.
Bundy Data, right back to you, Chief. I have a feeling you're going to shake your head. Bottom line, locate how many call girls have gone missing in the area from 1990 to 2021, missing women that fit the description. But it's not as simple as that, is it? Because just because he targeted, you know, escorts now, is it possible he killed a different type of woman 30 years ago who wasn't petite, who didn't have light eyes? Is it possible?
Yeah, it's very possible. Look, there's something unique about this guy. I haven't dissected every bit of his evidence like our guest has, but there's something unique about him being a serial killer. I don't think that he's like the normal serial killer that we're used to seeing and reading about. He's a little bit different, and that's the reason why he was able to operate and get away with it for so long.
Hmm. Beachy Broad, best guess. I'm a big fan of Max. She is so smart. Yes, she is. Followed by this. Don't know how I feel about this. I saw Joni Johnson in the Four Squares. I stopped to stay and listen. That means she's not stopping for any of us, but that's okay.
No. It's all good.
It's all good as long as you stopped and stayed. Dr. Joni, I wanted to ask you this question earlier. Do serial killers get this specific? All the escorts, sex workers were petite and had light eyes. Is it possible that he was that fixated that if someone came in with, let's say, black eyes, he just wasn't interested, and it would save their life, essentially?
There's a lot of variability among serial killers, and we used to always think they would pick out this very specific type that looked like their mom or their girlfriend who broke up with them or whatever. And I think what the research shows is that most serial killers have a preference. So somebody they prefer to be a victim, but there's also the issue of availability or accessibility. Yep. And so a lot of times it's a combination of the two. So, and sometimes you will see serial killers, even the ones who have a pretty strong preference and are willing to basically stalk potential victims, if there's an opportunity that presents itself, they'll take advantage of it. So there's just a lot of variability, but I think it's fair to say that most serial killers have a preference, but again, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to take advantage of opportunities that come their way.
Mm. So, Mac, I was very excited to talk to you and the chief specifically about this part. So this crime scene investigation at the home lasted almost 2 weeks. Your active CSI, have you ever spent that much time at one location?
No. No. But let me tell you what you're seeing. You are seeing next level serial killer, which requires a next level response.
That's right.
Period. And what I noticed right off the bat, when the medical examiner showed up with the storage unit, that was kind of like a oh crap moment, because they only show up for one thing, and that's human body remains. Then you noticed at the scene, you had their CSI, you had detectives, you had people from multiple different agencies, which was really important and necessary. Then the kicker, here comes dogs, here comes ground penetrating radar, and then here comes the crime lab. Now let me tell you something, that don't happen every day. Mm-hmm. So at that scene, you had the prosecutor, the lead detective, the lead CSI, and the lead person from the crime lab with all these tools and other agencies involved. That, to me, solidified they are doing next tier professional response in every way. And if you think about it, everything they're doing is a parallel investigation. It has to be. At the same time they're working the house, they're thinking of the storage room, they're thinking of New Jersey, they're thinking of Nevada. They're thinking and talking to South Carolina. Hey, Rhode Island is right there. Massachusetts is right there. One of the victims came from, Connecticut. Oh, Lord. So, again, you start adding these states. It's common sense. Where has this man lived? And think of what they already know, y'all. they've already told us he kills when his wife's out of town. She's from Iceland. So when she goes out of town, it's probably for at least a month at a time. So again, to Dr. Joni's point, if you're into torture porn, that you have to take your time to torture somebody. That ain't quick. That's a cigarette butt. That's a little knife, Nick. That's a little, I'm going to choke you a little bit and bring you back. It takes a while to act those fantasies out. So is there evidence in the home? I would put some money on it.
Authorities did reveal that a quote unquote massive amount of evidence had been recovered from his home. There were a number of items of evidence. This is the DA speaking now, who said, but I'm not going to say especially where, and also refused to comment on whether or not the search uncovered any trophies. They did say they did not find any human remains. Let's hold it there. Chief, to you, this is the stuff that I'm fascinated by because, you know, when you're 4 years old, like my son, you want to grow up and be a police officer. And I'm sort of the same way. Explain how a case of this magnitude, when you walk into a house, when the Cheryl Mack McCollum walks in there, you know, in her hazmat suit, the crime team investigators, who is running the show there? Who's telling who what to do? How does it all go down? I want to know. Take us inside this house.
Tell the truth, Chief.
Okay, all right. I'm gonna tell you the truth. This is how I know it. Inside the crime scene, as much as I want to say that this is my investigation, I'm the lead man on this case, and you gotta do what I tell you to do. I have zero control when it comes to that crime scene. I can't tell her to do nothing. You know, and it makes me so angry because look, I got an A-type personality. You need to have that A-type personality when you're working homicide cases. You are literally in the room with a killer. So you have to have a certain mindset. But man, on that crime scene, I can't tell you how many times that I tried to tell my crime scene investigator, hey, I need this done in the next 2 hours so I can work my case. And they were like, okay, well, I'll be done in 17 hours. You'll get the case when I get through with it, you know? So no, working with reasonable doubt or being a host of reasonable doubt opened my eyes up to so many things that I was doing wrong. Well, I won't say doing wrong, but I could have done better in investigations, man. So I just threw that in there. But here is the thing. What happens in a criminal investigation is there are two parallel investigations going when you think about the dichotomy that works between a homicide investigator and a crime scene investigator. They should work together as a system of checks and balances. What she finds on that crime scene should be backed up by the evidence that I find in my investigation.
Absolutely.
And that's how it works. They work together. I'm not above her. She's not above me. We work together, and our work together is what helps our criminal justice system work as it should. It should be a system of checks and balances. So, but I would love to say I was in charge of the crime scene investigation. No, I'm not. I have zero control of what happens because, you know, when it comes to testifying, I can't testify to the DNA that was found on the crime scene. I may have a general idea. I will have a general idea of the DNA that was found, but she's got to testify to that. But she can't testify to what was said to me by the defendant during my interview or during my interrogation because she wasn't there. But all of that works together. And that's how our criminal justice system should work. I'm not above her. She's not above me.
That's interesting. It reminds me a lot of news. There's always a push and pull between the reporter and the photographer because they usually edit the piece. You get a great interview. You want a certain soundbite. The editor, the photographer will say, I'll put that in if I've got time to put that in.
And exactly.
But it is.
That's exactly how it is between the homicide investigator and the crime scene.
It's a true team effort. So Mac, to you, you go in there. You're in your fancy hazmat suit, all in blue or white. What are you doing in there? When you get into that house, how do you know to turn left, turn right? What are you looking for? How do you know what to swab? I mean, especially a high profile case like this, how do you know where to even begin?
That's a great question. And I'm going to brag on the chief for a second, because what you just heard is somebody that is a solid investigator, because he can remove his ego, because the reality is he is in charge. And the reality is he can tell me what to do, but he knows that that scene, that's not the right call to make. So, you know, you often see on TV where somebody rolls up and the CSI goes up to the first, you know, person on the scene or the first detective and said, "Hey, Joe, what do we got?" I never do that. I don't want you to tell me. I want to tell you. So if you go in that scene and the chief's already done a walkthrough, and then when I get there, I do my walkthrough and I pinpoint what I think I see. So is this an accident? Is it a suicide? Is it natural? Or is it a homicide? Then when I go back out and say, "Chief, this is what I think." If we're on the same page, we're fixing to work the daylights out of that thing. If he says, "Wait a minute, I thought this was a suicide. Where are you getting homicide?" "Sugar, I got to go back in for a second. I'll be right back, because I have clearly missed something, or he has missed something, and then we need to go together. And then we need to pinpoint, what are you seeing? What did you notice that I didn't?" And then to me, that's where, again, the teamwork. So I want to be by myself for a minute, and then the communication. It is constant. And again, what I saw on the very little video clips that they did release, tractor trailers. Did y'all see those trailers? I mean, they were putting, y'all, I can't even imagine the amount of physical evidence. I can't. And, you know, they're looking in the yard. They're looking under the roof. Did you see them lifting the roof line? It's like, oh, my Lord. And just imagine, I heard somebody being interviewed that used the word hoarder. If that's the case, here's the problem at a crime scene, and Dr. Joni and the chief, I'm sure, can back me up. I often take things as evidence that I don't know how it fits right now. So if there's a photograph that's ripped up, I'm taking that photograph. I don't know why it's ripped up. Were they mad? Is it a love triangle? Is it a breakup? I don't know, but I want it because it doesn't look right. It shouldn't be here. If every single room in the house is just tore up, but the bathroom is pristine, I need some Luminol and some swabs, because something went down in that bathroom, right?
And how, so I have so many questions. I mean, how are you logging and keeping track of this? And let's say you find that picture that's torn up and you want that. You take out your paper bag, you put it in an evidence bag. How do you log all this in real time? How do you keep track of it?
Well, the first thing I'm going to go through first, and then I'm going to video it, and then I'm going to take photographs, and then I'm going to go back and put markers, and then I'm going to photograph again with the markers, and then I may do another video with all the markers and everything in place. So again, we can see it, and then I'm going to go outside with the chief and with the lead detective, and I'm going to say, "Look, I got 57 things. Am I missing anything?" Because you remember O.J. Simpson? They had a big list. They had everything. Yeah. They located the bloody fingerprint on the back of the gate, but nobody went back and collected it. So that's what you don't want to do. So again, I'm going to run through. Chief, am I forgetting anything? Detective, anything at all? Okay, let's go over this list one more time. I got 57 things. And then if somebody says, "Hey, what about that shovel?" Dang it, I forgot the shovel. How can I forget the shovel? But I'm going to go back and get the shovel, because it had soil on it, not clay. And the yard is clay-based. So you're going to want that shovel. I just forgot it. It was maybe too obvious. But again, teamwork.
And we're going to get back to that, because I am fascinated by it. But from Sue B to you, Dr. Joni, why is a toddler not listed with the other victims? I was not aware of that. I thought the toddler was. But bigger question to you, Dr. Joni Johnston, what are your thoughts on why a toddler is even showing up in this basically gravesite? Terry Marsh, the toddler, was a child of Peaches. I don't know what her real name is. Peaches was another sex worker who I think was discovered in a different location back in 97. But what do you make of this, Dr. Johnston?
Yeah, my first thought is that this is just collateral damage, if you will. And that's a horrible way to put a toddler who's been murdered. And so I apologize for saying it that way. But, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that he actually targeted this toddler. And the fact that she did or he did belong to another, one of his other victims makes me think that even more. So my sense is somehow they set up a date or whatever. Maybe she had to bring her child along, but she didn't have childcare. And so as a result of that, he decided to also murder the toddler. Those are my thoughts.
And
Chief, another perspective.
And Chief, it's important to point out that even though these bodies were discovered in 2010, they not necessarily were killed then. We don't know how far back necessarily. So this kind of goes back to the original point that this could have been going on for many years before. And also, what about the other, I believe there's 7 other victims in this, on these grounds, Gilgo Beach. Do you believe at this point that they will find that there's a link to Rex Huerman here? Or is it just so random that they would be here?
You know, I don't believe in randomness. I don't believe in coincidences when it comes to murder cases. So when you look into a case like this, I think you have to understand that, just like you said, these murders happen years before these bodies are being found in most cases. So that means that this person has a 5-year advantage over them. So the investigators, they have to be methodical in everything that they do. So if you find another body, you can't just assume that, you know, this body, because it's found in the location close to other bodies, that it's a part of this crime scene. You should never do that, because that is a tunnel vision when it comes to investigating cases. But you have to always keep that in mind in the wider scale of things. Okay, I may not be able to connect him to this crime, but as I'm investigating this case, everything about the body and the way that we found it, I need to keep it in mind while I'm looking for evidence that links this person to this crime. You can never, ever, ever, ever have tunnel vision in cases like homicides. I mean, that's the thing that screws up our criminal justice system, when you have such tunnel vision that you wrongfully convict someone that was absolutely innocent of a crime. And that's usually what happens when in a lot of those cases. It's not lack of education. It's not lack of knowledge. It's usually tunnel vision. It boils down to that one simple thing. And you can usually pick it out in a lot of these cases. I want to just give kudos to Max. She dropped a lot of jewels when she was speaking just a minute ago, a whole lot of jewels. And some of it may have gone over some of our heads, but
head maybe.
I'm sure it did. You know, but one thing that I wrote about in my book, The Case, I talked about going on crime scenes and how we would have every time I came out on a crime scene, because homicide, we're usually the last ones that are called out. So I get to a crime scene, and 9 times out of 10, you'll have a group of cops there over there talking about, the case. And they're usually saying about giving their own theories about what happened. You know, well, she's like this, so, you know, this must have happened and all this other stuff. And 90% of the time, if those guys are over there, I'm going that way, because
yes,
I don't want their speaking or the way that they think to affect me and the way that I investigate my cases. I want to go in with a clear mind and see things the way that I see them. And that way I'll investigate what I saw and not what I heard.
That's an amazing point right there. It's so interesting to me that you just said that, because back to news, I always made a point, whenever you show up at a crime scene in news or, you know, anything that's going on, there's always a gaggle of reporters. And I would always make it a point to keep my distance, because it's a herd mentality, right? Mm-hmm. And you start to think like they do. Yeah. So I'd always look or try to stay just with my photographer, go down the street that they weren't going down, and see if I could find something. So it's interesting to me, because there's some analogies between the two professions, I guess.
Absolutely.
To you, Dr. Johnson, from Lucy Bell, Many men who hire escorts are regular clients and develop relationships accompanied with fantasy that is more than transactional. Rex Huerman had multiple encounters with the victims before killing. Do you think we're going to find this out, that he was, you know, seeing these women on a you know, multiple times basis before he would then go in for the kill?
Well, this is the first I've heard that there's evidence that he has seen the victims more than once. So that's something that I have not heard before. I did find it kind of interesting that I believe it was his last victim, Ms. Costello, had apparently, there had been a ruse, I guess, that had happened the day before. She went with him where her boyfriend, alleged boyfriend, had come in and ended up taking his money, Rex Huerman's money, without performing sex. And I guess he was angry about that. And I thought it was kind of astonishing that he had managed to convince her, you know, after that, because I would think that would be a very frightening situation or a scary situation, because you've basically taken somebody's money from them, that you would agree to go back with them.
Yeah.
And so that's the only thing I've heard that might suggest either that he was incredibly persuasive, which, you know, that's not the, I guess, impression I've gotten from what other people have said necessarily, or that maybe he had had more than one encounter with her before. I don't know, but that is the first time I've heard that. And I just want to just comment, if you don't mind, Joel, just briefly a little bit on what our other chief, Mac and the chief, said, which is just the cognitive biases that we know in psychology, and how it's just kind of wonderful to hear as investigators and detectives and chiefs and stuff, how that's such a powerful part of the investigation, how important it is to go in without hearing from other people initially what their impressions are, because there's so much research that suggests that even when we think we're going in and we're totally looking at it objectively with fresh eyes, if we've heard things from other people about their opinions, it absolutely influences us. We start seeing things differently. And so it's just fascinating to hear that from both of you.
I would agree with that for sure. Mac, I got to ask you, and you got to answer honestly, at a scene like this, would you be scared at all of what you could find in that house?
Scared? No. I would not want to find things that would disturb me. But again, the way I approach my job, I have a son that's a goalie. And when he started that position in lacrosse, I would always tell him, you're the last chance to stop this person. Everybody else has failed. So I see my job very similar. The only way this person is going to get convicted is if I do my job correctly. I'm the last shot. So I've got to bag and tag and collect legally. I've got to do it scientifically. And so to me, that's more my focus. I don't know that I've ever been frightened about anything. No. I'm usually kind of adrenaline pumped up and ready to get in there. And
you got your Red Bull. You're ready to go.
I don't even need Red Bull sugar. I'm telling you, those lights and sirens go off. That radio starts blaring. I want to get right in the middle of it.
How much time do you usually spend at a scene, just to give people perspective? Because here they were there almost 2 weeks.
Well, I mean, again, I mean, everything has variables and everything, you know, kind of relates to, you know, a ton of things all at one time. But if it's, let's say it's an entering auto, I mean, it could be an hour, hour and a half. If it's a homicide, I mean, you're talking about 6-8 hours. You know, I mean, you want to be there as long as it takes. So again, if it's something unusual, if it's a double scene, if it's a scene that looks staged in some way or gives you pause, then it's going to take a little bit longer. But, you know, I usually tell people there ain't no such word as deader. So take your time. Nothing else can happen to this poor person. So do not get in a hurry, because, you know, you don't want to miss something and we don't have the pleasure of going back. You know, you can always revisit a scene, but I'm talking about where it's there, where it's live, where everything is. The cigarettes are, you know, butts are going to be gone. The trash is going to be emptied. So you want to be the person, you know, look in the commode, look in the refrigerator. Look in the trash can. If you've got somebody telling you, oh, you know, he goes to church every time the doors are open. Well, I sure couldn't find a Bible in that house, right? But then you open the refrigerator and it's, you know, full of beer and whatnot. And then you look in the bedside table drawer. Ain't no Bible there either. and you're pretty shocked what you find there. So again, the story starts to build itself. And I usually tell rookies, you don't tell the scene what happened. The scene is going to tell you what happened.
Detective Phil Waters investigated over 400 homicides. He always says that on the show. Always.
True.
You let the scene tell you.
100%.
What do you make of those disturbances in the ground that they found?
Me?
Yeah.
Listen, there is nothing they took out of that house that ain't relevant. We may not know what it is, but I'm telling you, everything I saw them do, they had cadaver dogs. Then they had ground penetrating radar. Then they went to digging. And not just with, you know, little shovels or something. They had earth moving equipment. And what they found, they laid out and they photographed just like I would do on a sheet that's clean, evidence, you know, evidence free. So when they start putting these pieces of puzzles together, it could be something like a belt buckle or a zipper or jewelry, something that would have been on a victim that he wanted to keep close to him possibly. Again, we don't know yet, but I watched them. They all had all the protective gear in the world on. They photographed everything. They located it with the technology that they had, and they took it. So it means something.
Chief, what do you make of, we talked about a little bit earlier, the mattress in the vault. So Suffolk County DA Raymond Tierney, he said that they did find this vault, but they would not confirm or deny the mattress. The vault, according to them, is big enough to walk into, and it's in the basement. It was like the rest of the house. They said it was cluttered. As a seasoned investigator, is your antenna going up when you hear about this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are. I think we all agree that, you know, a lot of these murders happen in the area where he felt more comfortable, you know, and that just goes into the type of person he is. You know, there are certain things that are special to him. So he wants that more time with it. And I say he. Of course, he stands accused. I don't want to convict the man until after he's been convicted. But my antennas are completely raised. I'm kind of surprised that they say that it's cluttered because that just kind of goes back to what the doctor said. You know, that they all have differences. You know. The serial killers that I've dealt with, or the one that I dealt with, he was very messy about what he did. But I found one case that I know that this young man would have been a serial killer had we not caught him when we did. He killed two young ladies, and he killed one inside of his house, and then he killed my victim inside of her house. And he was very meticulous in things that he did to his victims. You know, he would always pose them in a way that every orifice of their body was exposed. The victim that he killed in his own house, he took her out and put her inside of her vehicle, and he posed her inside of her own vehicle. You know, so these are some of the things that you see, that these are just differences. And I told you about the truck driver. He was just killing girls inside of his truck and throwing them out of the car. So, you know, everybody has their own specific thing that they are into. I mean, it stands true with serial killers also. So, you know, yeah. Does it raise my antennas that he has this, I'm not going to say it's a torture chamber because I hadn't seen it, but I can imagine this is probably where he committed most of his acts against his victims.
Wow. Heavy. Back to NJ Coolchick here for you, Dr. Johnston. When he, Rex Heuermann, finally realizes there's too much evidence to not confess, do you think he'll do what Gary Ridgway did and lead law enforcement to more victims? He gives me Gary Ridgway vibes. Any take on that? There's a couple of good psychology questions here.
Yeah, I mean, that is another great question. I mean, I'll tell you my opinion about that. And my opinion about that is I can't imagine Rex Heuermann thinking there's ever too much evidence not to confess. The only way I can, and I can see him getting convicted and having nothing left to lose, and at some point not having any other attention or anything like that, I can see him at that point kind of embracing his actions, you know, cooperating with law enforcement, kind of getting a lot of attention, maybe taking them to other bodies or those kinds of things. But I personally see that happening way down the road if he does that, because like I said, I think he is going to claim that he's a victim in this whole thing as long as he possibly can. It's hard for me to even imagine him doing a plea deal. I see him going all the way through the process. And then, like I said, later on, maybe when he realizes that his appeals are exhausted, he's not going to get out, then maybe he pulls that card.
Yeah, and he said that, at least the defense attorney has said, that there will not be a plea deal, at least at this point. Sally Vell, if I understand this question, do you think they want to be the expert that the FBI comes to for answers on other serial killers and their motives or what they'll do next? I think the question here, if I understand it correctly, do you think these guys get off on knowing more than authorities or law enforcement and having them kind of beg them for answers to help solve their crimes? Is that an aspect of all this?
Well, we know that the BTK made a big statement. I don't know if you heard it, but he came forward and basically said, this guy's my clone. Mm-hmm. I predicted exactly how he would be. He's just like, he wanted to be just like me. So I absolutely think that sometimes, you know, these serial killers do want the recognition. They do like the thought that I know my comrades, right, better than anybody else does. And that's why a lot of times they will agree, sometimes reluctantly, to even help law enforcement try to catch somebody because it boosts their ego and their narcissism.
Well, one other one here that I think is interesting, from Strawberry Wine to you, Dr. Joni. I know we'll start to wrap it up. Could his first murder have been accidental during a violent assault and he enjoyed it so much that he continued murdering? Does that happen where they, you know, go a little too far and enjoy it a little too much?
It sometimes does happen. So one of two things tends to happen. If there's this progression of behavior where you get, you know, sexual assaults and then eventually the person, you know, commits a sexual assault and a murder. So sometimes it's just the progression of the fantasy. So they're escalating kind of more and more, and their behavior is kind of in response to their fantasies kind of get ramping up. But I have definitely seen serial killers who at least have claimed that their first victim, that's what happened, that they were engaging in sexual assault, things got out of hand, the person died, and it was the ultimate thrill, and then they continue. Now, whether that's true or not, only that person knows. But I definitely know a few serial killers who have claimed that to be the case.
Mac, Jay says Mac is the greatest, which is why I'm going to ask her the next question. You kind of mentioned this in passing about burner phones. So I was reading something today on this, and it says that the case hinges largely on the cell phone records, evidence, including the burner phones that he thought was going to conceal his identity. But apparently the more you use these phones, the more there's a pattern, and patterns are what get you caught. So is it sort of a fallacy that these burner phones keep you safe if you're trying to engage in criminal activity?
Well, for the criminals listening, yeah. So here's the deal. He made a couple of mistakes here. One, he kept all the phones. So typically, like, let's say you're in the mob, you're going to get a burner phone, you're going to use it for a day, you're going to get rid of it. You're going to get another phone. He didn't do that. He kept these phones. And then not only did he keep the phones, he kept them with his phone. So as he's traveling to the different places, the phones are traveling in concert. So again, that's a bad look. What I think's going to happen is this guy is a trained, educated architect that's going to follow him with these crimes. I believe we're going to see journals, maps, things that he has kept, codes that he has. So for example, we may not believe that the victims, none of them were shot, but that doesn't mean some of those weapons weren't used to control them, right? So I think he's kept things. I think he's kept some type of, like, dossier, basically, that has shown what he's been doing, very similar to a BTK. I think he will take that mechanical mind, and there will be some type of spreadsheet, basically. So I think the things that you saw them getting out of those houses and storage rooms, the banker boxes are full of files. And I think it's going to be, again, a money tree.
Simba, the Brazilian, best regards from Brazil. We are international. Thank you for all your expertise, shared in easy to understand manner. Wonderful variety of accents. Mac, they picked up on your Bronx accent. I love that. It's awesome. And look who's here, everyone. The one and only Carrie Rawson. She's in the chat. So shout out to Carrie. And I'm glad she's here right now because one thing I wanted to get to, two things. One of them is that the family now of Rex Uhrmans has found this unlikely ally, and that is the daughter of another notorious serial killer, the Happy Face Killer, a guy named Keith Jesperson. Melissa Moore is his daughter. She launched a GoFundMe campaign for Uhrmans' estranged wife. They've raised, as of that time, $13,000 from 390 donations. Dr. Johnson, what about people like Carrie Rawson, who are brave enough to come forward, and the daughter now of the Happy Face Killer, even going so far as to start a GoFundMe, that gives you a little, restores your faith in humanity. Earlier, I was going to ask the chief, you know, how does he keep his head straight seeing all these horrible things? But this gives us a little faith in humanity, doesn't it?
It does. And I think, and I don't know if you were listening earlier, Carrie, but I was kind of giving you a shout out earlier because I do think you and a couple of other people really have just, you know, the few of you have really done an incredible job of helping the media understand that victims has a lot of different meanings. And when you're talking about a serial killer, that the family of that perpetrator are also victims that are reeling and dealing with grief and dealing with shock and horror and all kinds of things. And I think that I've not before this particular case seen the media try to be more respectful of the families and presenting them in a way that separates out this family from the perpetrator. So I want to give a shout out to you because I think you've had a lot to do with that.
Very well said. Chief, to you, one of the things Carrie's saying, this is good to hear, having a better day, guys. Thanks so much. Good to hear. Chief, to you, you know, one of the things that I think kind of upset Carrie in hearing the news about all this is the way this house was really ripped apart because it similar stuff, you know, she dealt with similar things. But, you know, is there any way around that from an investigative standpoint? I mean, they've got to do their due diligence. Mac, you want to take that since you're the one in there actually doing the digging and stuff. But how do you respond to that?
Here's the deal. If that's my scene, I'm going to go in the walls. I'm going to pull up the baseboards. I don't know where he's hidden things. Every single person that grew up in a home has a hidey hole, whether it was for cigarettes or your diary, whatever it was. That's his childhood home. I got to find that hidey hole. And then, you know, there's things in my head like John Wayne Gacy. You know, you've got to go look. And unfortunately, you know, that's just part of it. And it's the ripple effect of a case like this. Nobody gets out of there without some trauma. Not the first responders, not the victims' families that are watching this on TV, praying that there's evidence, but then not wanting there to be anything of their loved one in that house. Not his family, not the neighbors, nobody. Nobody's getting out of this thing without some harm. And frankly, that goes to Carrie Rawson too. She was going about her life and this news broke and then everybody in the world's contacting her. All of her stuff comes up to the surface and Dr. Joni can talk about that. For the officers that had worked a child case the weekend before is now looking for how many bodies? 4, 10, 20? I mean, it's horrible. It's horrible. But nobody's going to win on this thing. Nobody.
In case you missed it, Mark A. Carrie was the star of the show last night, despite a stellar cast. We had Mark Safarik, who's amazing, and Dr. Ann Burgess, who is literally named a living legend. So she was in good company last night. Dr. Joni Johnston is a living legend in my eyes, a forensic psychologist, private investigator, and crime writer. She stepped in last minute, so we really appreciate it. She's the author of Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask. She also hosts her own YouTube channel, Unmasking a Murderer. Dr. Joni, your final thoughts tonight, as the story obviously is going to continue to unwind in different weird ways, as we know there's a press conference coming tomorrow morning. Even.
Yeah, I mean, I think my last comments are just questions. I mean, I feel like we are at the very beginning of this investigation. And so I'm just looking forward to seeing what unfolds. I'm happy to see that I think there is more sensitivity than there has been in the past in terms of treating victims' families, whether that's Rex Hurwitz's wife and his children, or whether that's the victims' families, who deserve a tremendous amount of support and love as well. And I, you know, appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about it. And it's so great to see so many people who are interested in criminal justice and seeing, you know, fairness and justice served. So I just look forward to seeing what's going to happen next.
Well said. Royal Castriata, Super Sticker, One Hair, you were there, but you got to remember what the chief said. You got to be careful with the DNA. Kerry Rawson, everyone give her a virtual hug. I could use the hugs. I'd love to give Cheryl Mack McCollum a hug. She is a current CSI investigator. She's an Emmy Award winner. She's done it all. She is a writer for Crime Online. She holds a master's degree in criminal justice. The list goes on. She's the author of the textbook Cold Case. She does it all. And the name of your podcast is Zone. I don't want to screw up the numbers.
Zone 7.
Zones. Oh, I can't screw up those. Why did I think there was? I thought there was four digits. I don't know why. Zone 7. Can't screw that up. And 7 is my mom's birthday, so now I will never forget that. So, Mac, what's next for this investigation?
It's going to get deeper and wider and more twisted. Period. It is. I'm telling you. It is.
If you had, let me put you on the spot. If you had to put a number on his victims, are you going double digits?
Easy. We're already in double digits. We're already at 11. They just hadn't said it.
Yeah.
But you're talking about somebody that conservatively has had 40 years, potentially. And let me tell you about this guy now. When I say he's next level, there are a ton of serial killers that will return to the scene of the crime. It might even show up and stand off in a distance at the funeral. This man kept the victim's phone, called her sister by name, and told her what he did to her sister. So when I tell you next level, baby, y'all got to get ready. And we got to be real supportive of everybody. Because I will tell you, you want to know how dark and dirty that house was? Look at Delphi, Indiana. The wife so far has stayed by the husband. She literally said to one media person, he's my person. Okay. This lady, how quick did she get a divorce? So she processed all of that information they were telling her. Your husband's been arrested. He's been arrested for murder. We think he's a killer of more than one woman. We think he's a Long Island serial killer. And she went and filed for divorce within days. So that tells you, if she was able to do that, her knowledge inside that house was violent, controlling, manipulative. She's been abused for a long time.
Yeah. We heard from Laura Richards last night, the crime analyst, and she was talking about coercive control and exactly that. So be interesting to find out more about that. Kim Catagrion. Cheryl, I'm from the South and have many things in common with you. My 11th grade students heard your podcast and said, dang, either Mrs. or Mac. I don't know if that's a typo, but one or the other. So got to be careful with your podcast. You got 11th graders listening to it, Mac. So no cursing on there.
Well, there's no profanity. Y'all come on.
Is it me or does Mac have the best voice? I could listen to this voice all day long. But
yes.
Another guy with
a deep South.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're the other one with that voice. It is Chief, formerly Detective Sergeant Chris Anderson, retired Birmingham PD, veteran with 27 years of experience in law enforcement, hosted Reasonable Doubt, was on A&E's First 48 Birmingham. He is the host of the Crime and Cookie Juice podcast and author of the book, The Case. Buy it on Amazon right now. Chief, you've got the final say. What do you expect? What are you looking for next in this case?
I agree wholeheartedly with what everybody else has said. We are really just at the beginning of this case, the beginning of this investigation. It's going to get more and more twisted. You talked about, do we think that he's in the double digits? Yeah. You think about it. If he has a 40-year run, you know, and he killed maybe two a year. Mm-hmm. 80 people. That's 80 victims, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is just crazy. And I think it's more than that, because he seems, if he's progressed to a point in his life where he feels emboldened enough to call a victim or a victim's family member and brag about the killings, that shows the type of personality he has. So he's not going to be, it's not going to quench his appetite with just one or two. And he's getting away with it. So, yeah, I do believe that you'll see multiple other victims. And I agree with Doc when she says that there needs to be more support for all victims within these circles of crime. You know, not only the victim's family members, but the suspect's family members. And I think Mac mentioned this, and I, like I said, Mac, I love you, dude. You have been dropping jewels all night. I'm currently writing a book right now about the PTSD involved in law enforcement. And we all know in law enforcement, you know, it's kind of taboo to say that you're a cop and you suffer from PTSD. So my book will be more about my journey with the undiagnosed PTSD that I've went through years and years of turmoil and not understanding what it was that was wrong with me and not seeking the help that I needed to seek.
Good for you.
To survive. So, because it happens, it's out there. And I think that if we unmask the veil that has been cloaked around law enforcement about this issue, then I think we'll open up a lot of doors into finding out true healing within my profession.
Very eloquently said, and Dr. Johnson is shaking her head in agreement, and Dr. Johnson, I mean, it is important. These first responders see some of the worst things in life, and I think we all take it for granted, right?
I agree, and I think the impact can be cumulative. You know, people, amount of violence people are exposed to, detectives are exposed to, and the kinds of violence you're exposed to, it has to have an impact on people over time. And it's time that people, like you said, realize that. And I think you're the perfect person to do that, to write that book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Agreed.
And just to show MC Spunky, let me know that Kerry was in the chat. She's probably been in here for like an hour. Just so you guys know, I'm looking at notes. I'm looking at questions. I do come prepared, and the comments kind of lag behind a little bit. So apologies to Kerry if she was there. I had to read this comment three times, but it's funny. Elizabeth Whitney, Chris's wife has a hot husband.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I'll make sure I tell her that tonight.
I hope the chief's wife is listening. But I hate saying goodbye because I can go on for another 5 hours, and we'll get everyone back soon enough, hopefully in the next week or two, to continue this story. Quick programming note, tomorrow, 10:30 a.m., there's going to be a news conference from Suffolk County, Long Island. We are going to do our best to take that live tomorrow with some guests, and then we're back tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern time for Great Scott, it's your true crime, Phil, with FBI Scott Duffy and former Houston homicide detective Phil Waters. And Sunday night, I'm looking to do another show on UAPs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon. We do that on Sunday night sometimes. I did an interview, a one-on-one with Ross Colthart, who interviewed the UFO whistleblower. And that episode has like 350,000 views. People are really interested. I don't know, maybe we're not alone. Who knows? Maybe there are crime scene investigators on other planets. We will we will find out one day. But until then, love you, America. Love you, San Diego. Love you, Atlanta. And love you, Berlin.